This is Jamie Mustard, author of The Iconist, The Art and Science of Standing Out, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help us both keep up with the latest ideas in the quickly changing fields of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction and save you some time. This show is a labor of love that I do in my spare time. My day job is running a marketing agency where we work with manufacturers and industrial companies to help them grow by helping them earn the attention and trust of their prospective customers. For more, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers, and you'll find the guide atop the organic results. This episode is sponsored by David Meerman Scott's phenomenal New Marketing Mastery course that he developed with Tony Robbins. New Marketing Mastery will teach you step by step how to get your marketing in alignment with the way your customers want to buy. David spent 3 years putting together over 50 videos, dozens of infographics and worksheets, and a 50-page workbook to get your marketing to generate a lot more sales. And even nicer, Marketing Book Podcast listeners will get $500 off by entering promo code Marketing Book. To sign up, go to newmarketingmastery.com, but make sure to enter promo code Marketing Book for that $500 off. You can find a short video about the course and a link to it in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Jamie Mustard to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Iconist, The Art and Science of Standing Out, published by Ben Bella Books. Now, careful listeners to the Marketing Book Podcast will know that I normally read a short bio of the author, but after 260-something episodes, I want to do something a little differently for Jamie's bio. I want to quote from the beginning of the book. I currently work as a messaging, design, and communications expert, consulting with entrepreneurs and new businesses, as well as successful artists, brands, CEOs, and innovators, some of whose stories are in this book. All of them, even the highly successful ones, came to me struggling to be heard in a world overloaded with too much of everything. My unconventional life's journey led me to explore the art and science of standing out and eventually uncover a solution that can help everyone. As a child of poverty and neglect, I was rarely in school and had little parental supervision. It was a confusing time for me. My days were shapeless and my focus was scattered. As a kid, time already seemed to move slowly. The smog-refracted sun of the polluted Los Angeles sky only added to my languor. Burning gray concrete was the only world I knew. I recall struggling to remember what rain looked like. In these barren LA neighborhoods, we were the featureless, futureless kids that would eventually serve as America's lower rung. I feared my future would be an agonizing one of physical labor and drudgery. Eventually, I turned things around, graduated high school, and then going on to attend the London School of Economics. Yet it would be 20 years before I realized that the seeds sown in those early years of deprivation, invisibility, and struggle were the precursors to a major passion in my adult life, discovering what it takes to make something, anything, stand out despite the avalanche of information in the world. My work has focused essentially on the economics of attention. Jamie, congratulations on The Iconist, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the congratulations. That I've never had that read to me before. That was kind of emotional to listen to, actually.
Well, your book was a pleasure to read. You have a very interesting writing style, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And the book is of course, beautifully designed, and we'll talk about that. But I do have to ask one question that I'm sure most listeners are thinking about. Are you any relation to Colonel Mustard?
Yes, he is my great third uncle. No, absolutely not. It's a complete coincidence.
Okay. That, we're talking about the game of Clue. And so I hope that'll be the last stupid joke I make. But I have to give thanks to a former guest on the Marketing Book Podcast, Alexandra Watkins. She's the author of Hello, My Name is Awesome, which may have been the funniest interview I've done. And her book was all about naming products and services and companies and so forth. She recommended this book. She's seen you speak, and she hasn't recommended anyone else. So there you go.
I recently became friends with her. We were both shortlisted for the OWL Award, the Outstanding Works of Literature Award. And she is a hilarious person. Marches to her own drummer.
Yes, very true. And you know what? This may be the third book I know of that's been nominated for that OWL Award.
Okay. Did you interview Nir Eyal?
Yes, I interviewed Nir Eyal. And actually, there's four books because the fourth one was Paul Smith, who wrote The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell.
Yeah, we have all these connections. Well, I've recently become friends with Alexandra, and we had mutual friends. Nir and I share a publisher, and Paul Smith and I share the same literary agent. So this is getting kind of creepy, Douglas.
Wow, man. Yeah. I've fallen in with a very nice group of authors there. So I will continue to plumb the depths of that.
And I will say about my last name, Mustard, you know, growing up with that last name was torturous because, you know, you go to a new school and you're going to gym class, they say the last name's first, Murphy, you know, and then Mustard, and everybody laughs, right? But now that I'm an adult and I'm kind of this creative director, story brand, branding, messaging expert, I love that last name and I feel like I've earned it.
Yeah. Yes. And I just had to wonder, like, is that your real name or is that your nom de plume?
I'm very proud to say at this point that it is my real name. It is the name on my birth certificate. Yeah.
Terrific. Terrific. So this book is probably one I'm going to be reading from in this interview more than any others I've done. But I just have to read part of the introduction because it really spoke to me and I'm sure the other readers. If we do not grab the attention of others immediately, we could lose them forever. There is no doubt that technology has made our lives easier, but it has also made our lives harder in invisible ways. Technology-induced change has created an explosion of content and choice, a deluge of products, services, and voices, and constant competition for our attention. In our always-on, internet-connected world, wave after wave of information bombards our senses and dilutes our individual voices. Whether we are conscious of it or not, we're drowning in a sea of white noise. As noise around us grows into a never-ending thrum, it reduces our ability to hear one another. Artists struggle to grow their audiences. Writers fail to retain readers' concentration. Advertisers' work fails to generate sales. Innovators can't get support for their ideas. Businesses have a harder time attracting new customers. We're trying to stand out, but because of the digital onslaught, people are so overwhelmed that they are only partially paying attention. Being noticed is the first step to success. Being remembered is the next. But those two factors have become nearly impossible to control. How can you guarantee that anyone will look at what you're doing in a sea of other options? How can you be sure you'll stick in their minds? And then going on, you say, in The Iconist, I will teach you how to stand out, capture attention, and imprint in the mind. Whatever field you work in, I will show you how to use these patterns of human perception to craft completely irresistible content that demands engagement from others. Despite its simplicity, what makes something catch our eye is so obvious that it can be hard to see. So much of the time, we're so close to our art or our work that we can't understand how to value it and represent ourselves with simplicity to grab the attention we deserve. I am offering you a formula to get this right every time. The stories I'll tell here show the irresistible laws of attention from many angles so that everyone from a child to a CEO can use them. So, Jamie, what is an iconist?
An iconist is a term that I coined for someone that uses the laws in my book to get attention with deliberation and at will, rather than hope, luck, chance, time, or years. So what I'm saying is that we think we call a Kleenex or a Coke because of luck and years of imprints and time. But really, it has to do with how people prefer to take in information. And once you understand those rules of how people prefer to take in information, you can move your what you're trying to say, no matter what your medium, 3 inches to the left or right, and you can make something iconic in the mind of the person you're talking to, the people you're trying to reach, in a matter of 5 minutes with certainty rather than 5 years and hope. That's what an iconist is.
Excellent. So let's step back, though, and let me ask you to explain a bit more about what I mentioned in the read from in the introduction, what our constantly connected world means for everyday people in terms of our focus and personal outlook and the problems it poses for anyone trying to reach an audience.
Okay. Well, I would start off by saying this statement. Anything busy, anything that your audience can't comprehend before they even have the chance to think, gets instantly discarded. And that is because of a term that I coined in the book called dilution, where I'm basically saying we're so overwhelmed with content now that we've become more and more invisible. Our own message has become diluted. You know, from the economic standpoint, not to get technical, like we talk about the economics of attention, right? In economics 101 class, you have a supply and demand curve. When there's less of something, the price and the value goes up. When there's more of something, the price and the value goes down, where there's an oversupply. So we have an oversupply of information, which makes all information less valuable. To give a specific example, if you were to walk down the street in your hometown in 1952, you would probably throughout your day see about 250 advertising messages in a single day. By the last time I saw this researched was in the late 90s, and that number was up to 7,000 advertising messages a day. A human being couldn't process 1,000. So whereas in the 50s, if you were a baker, you would be competing with all the other bakers in your town, maybe two other bakers. If you lived in a big city, 10 bakers. Today, because of content overload, everything competes with everything. And all of us have become diluted in terms of the attention span is shorter and people just, they either get you in a second or they move on. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the sea of white noise changing the game in terms of how we need to communicate to each other.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you talk about how our brains work much more visually, and a larger part of our brain is for visual things rather than a smaller, slower part, which is for all the text. So just before we got in this interview, I received an email from a university in Texas asking me to take a survey for a academic study of content marketing that they're doing. And the email looked like the Declaration of Independence in small Arial type. It was so overwhelming. And I just said, no, I just deleted it. I couldn't, they didn't even think about putting a summary on there or anything like that. So it's so true. And as Jay Baer likes to say, we're, you know, all our content is now competing with cat videos.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I give an example in the book of kind of how we teach children, how children learn and how we get the attention of children. Mm-hmm. We use large picture books. Sesame Street has the count. 1, 2. We use this big, bold imagery, the kind you see in a road sign or a warning label. But as we get above elementary learning, we stop communicating to each other in elementary ways. So what I'm trying to say in The Iconist is that in a world overloaded with content, where it's like a constant storm that we're almost trying to push away from us, this visual, oversized, simplistic visual way of communicating becomes even more addictive, is even more craved by your customers and the audience that you're trying to reach. They're so overwhelmed by busyness that if you can give them something super simple and super Sesame Street, not just in terms of the concept you're communicating, but also visually, that you'll instantly already have a huge advantage over your competitors.
And that's got to be tough medicine for some people to take in. For instance, that email that I got today from some academic group, and they're probably thinking it's all about the data, it's all about the our information, and why would someone not want to do this? I look at a website, and it's just, it's full of text. It's not giving any consideration to the context or how it's going to be consumed, and I just skip right past it. And I want to quote another little short sentence here from your book and let you know that I thought you were talking about me, okay? And I was starting to get really self-conscious. And you said, "We all know someone whose success confounds us. The mediocre actor, the incompetent boss, the tone-deaf pop star, the bumbling politician. We watch them succeed, furrow our brows, and ask, why them?" And I hear that a lot, actually, Jamie, when people talk about me. And it's really kind of unsettling that people just talk about me right in front of me. But anyway, I want you to explain, though, why achieving your goals has more to do with your ability to stand out from the crowd and ensure that your message is heard. Why is that more important than someone's capabilities or their ideas or whatever? That's tough medicine for a lot of people to think. For instance, somebody who says, "Oh, you know, I don't have a website," or "Oh, I'm not on social media," or "I'm not on LinkedIn." Not that they have to be, but it's sort of like, no, I've built a better mousetrap, and it's very, very complicated and technical. And if people can't understand it, well, that's just because they're not smart. What's the big fundamental mistake that's happening there?
Well, when Bill Taylor, the co-founder of Fast Company, endorsed my book, there was a phrase or a sentence in there that I really loved. He said, "Scarcity of attention is the defining business challenge of our time." In 1998, a woman who was doing research for Microsoft and Apple, a woman named Linda Stone, coined the term continuous partial attention. And it was basically to describe how we were all being bombarded with so much content that we were only partially paying attention to the people around us. Now, what's interesting about that is there's lots of books that talk about how we're distracted all the time and what it's doing to us to have a shorter attention span, to be distracted. There's an incredible book that got nominated for the Pulitzer Prize called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, by Nicholas Carr. Okay. What makes my book different, what I'm interested in is, if the person you're trying to communicate to, whether it's an email, whether it's showing them a painting, whether it's having them come out to your show, your live show at a local showcase or a venue, what I'm interested in is, if everyone around you is distracted, what does it do to you that you can't get their attention? What is the impact on the person trying to get attention, and what does it mean for their life? And it actually has severe psychological consequences, because we all know it's harder and harder to get attention, but we don't all talk about it. So that has psychological consequences, which, if you want, I could get into. But let me summate by saying two things. Linda Stone said that the internet was barely going. That was the time we had 7,000 advertising messages a day. A person couldn't process 1,000. That was before social media, before Twitter, you know, before Google ads, right? So that number is probably closer to 10 to 15,000 today, probably closer to 15,000, maybe more. A person couldn't process 1,000. So it's kind of like, if I throw a golf ball at you, what would you do? You would catch it. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I threw 15,000 golf balls at you all at once, what would you do? You would turn away from it. You would cower, and you would be in the fetal position. This is how bombarded the people that you're trying to reach are. So what I'm saying is that no matter what, at this point in our human existence, before you do anything, the first step is to get someone's attention. Doesn't matter how good you are. You could be at the best in the world at whatever you do. If you don't have someone's focused, engaged attention, it's not going to mean anything. So the first thing is to communicate to people, get attention first, and then go from there. Then obviously you have to deliver something that's wonderful and have a great message or a great product and a great output. Getting attention also means that if you're horrible at what you do, people will see that. But attention is the most important commodity of our time, and no one's talking about it.
Absolutely. It's so true. And it's something that I was at a meeting with a client not long before I read the book, and they were saying, well, we're going to do an email newsletter and talk about ourselves and, you know, the services we offer and some of the projects we've done. I just wanted to read from this book. They're a very good company, but it's almost like, you know, even this client's mom, well, you know, is overwhelmed, doesn't really care about this stuff, and she loves the guy. So it's sort of like, that's the thing I've been talking about more and more. People don't understand that the most valuable thing now is the attention. Whereas in the past, it might have been space, you know, buying advertising space, or, you know, there was a more of a limited supply. But with all that content being produced, and I have to tell you, I always know a book has a big impact when we start taking action on our own website or our own business, and we're in the process of saying, nope, we still got too much stuff on our homepage. We got to get it down. And dang it, Mustard, it's because of you from reading this book. But talk about how too many choices paralyze people. In other words, less is easier to process, and there are even a couple terms in there that I love called ego depletion and decision fatigue.
Yeah. Well, there's, a wonderful book from the early 2000s, I think 2004, by Barry Schwartz, who's a professor of social theory at Skidmore College and a psychologist. And he talks about the mental manifestations from having too many choices, that when we have too many choices, and when you do a Google search, you might get 100,000 choices. And then on the first page, there's 15. And then what we don't often think about, we're always thinking about ourselves and what we want to say. We don't often think about the person on the other end of that who's got to make a decision and looks at 10 websites and wants to know which one to choose and can't. So when someone has too many choices, they go through the following kind of psychological manifestations. They have anxiety about choice. What if I choose the wrong one? They won't make a choice at all. They feel paralyzed. And ultimately, they can even be depressed, like, I'm not even, you know, I just feel like I can't make any of these choices. Mm-hmm. And then if they do make a choice, then they wonder, did I choose the right one? They feel dissatisfied. Okay.
Yeah. And that for me spoke to the issue of how hard it's becoming to buy.
It is. And I found that there's similar cycle through my clients over doing this for the last 15 years with the techniques that I codify in The Iconist, is that those same mental manifestations exist for people when they feel like they can't get attention. They have a lot of anxiety. Are people going to even look at this and give it a chance? Like, will I get the eyeballs? They have anxiety about that. They feel paralyzed. Why even try if no one's going to even look? I know if they look, I would be the number one choice. But since they won't even look, why am I even going to try? They can ultimately feel depressed about getting attention and dissatisfied with their lives because they know that they have something great and they can't get that scarce commodity, the attention, that this thing that's become this a very scarce commodity, the attention they deserve. So I wrote The Iconist as a way to give any person the ability to read the book and walk away, no matter what they do, whether they're a scientist or a CEO or a person just sending an email to a colleague or their boss, so that they could walk away knowing that they'll at least get the attention for their idea that they desire.
Right. So let's get into some of the key concepts in your book, and that is blocks and icons. I would like you to explain blocks and icons. In fact, how they're the antidote to overwhelming choice, and, you know, explain their deceptively simple psychology. I mean, I'll be honest. As I was reading through the book, I'm thinking it can't be that simple. But then I started thinking about how I react to the examples you have in the book, and I thought, wow, no, it really is.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to explain it, I could go through how it works in some different mediums. And
please, yeah.
I mean, it's a long. I wrote a book on it, so it's kind of a long explanation. But
yeah, I'll be back in a little while. Go ahead.
Okay. What I will say is this: okay, all a block is, which is a term like dilution. Dilution means, you know, you're drowning in the sea of white noise, and no one can see you anymore because there's too many things around you. It's a term I coined. Another term I coined in the book is a block, and all a block is an icon waiting to happen. So if I take a really simple thing and I repeat it that you can understand before you have a chance to think, and I repeat it over and over and over, and then after 5 minutes, that's imprinted in your mind. The minute the imprint takes place, it's no longer a block. It's an icon because it's been taken hold in the mind of your audience or your listener.
Okay. So,
a block is basically an example just an icon. Of that. A block is something you craft and you repeat over and over, and then it's an icon waiting to happen. So let's take an example, a visual example. I mean, I like to kind of give art examples before I get into business examples because they're easier to understand. Mm-hmm. But by the time I get to the business example, people have their head wrapped around it. It's really simple, though. The really cool thing about my book is that it's what I'm explaining is everywhere and all around you. So as you start to get the idea, you see it everywhere. It's kind of hard to argue with. I didn't come up with it. I just spotted the pattern and wrote about it and gave you a bunch of really hopefully interesting stories and social and scientific research to show that this is true. Mm-hmm. But an example, say in art, right? I ask people who are the most known kind of in our ubiquitous pop culture minds, the most known artists of our time. And most people, if you walked up to them on the street and they knew nothing about art and you were, you know, somewhere in, you know, you were in Prague and you walked up to a guy who didn't go to university and he knew nothing about art, that person may not know a Picasso, but they would know a Van Gogh or a Warhol. And one thing that Van Gogh and Warhol did is they both used this concept of blocks in all their major works. So with Van Gogh, every image fills up the entire canvas. You can understand it before you have a chance to think in a Sesame Street-like way. So a bedroom, a cafe, a starry night, sunflowers, a pair of boots, a bull. It's a massive, simple image. Same thing with Warhol. You have Marilyn, a Campbell soup can, Muhammad Ali's head. It's a massive, simple image that takes up, you know, a Brillo box that takes up the entire canvas that you can understand before you have a chance to think. If you take something really simple like that in a signature style and you repeat it, it takes hold in the mind much faster. And that is why Warhol and Van Gogh enter our collective consciousness in such a ubiquitous way. If you were to take it to music, it's a dominant nursery rhyme type melody. So any simple melody repeated, it's the reason Beethoven's Which he was derided for as being too childlike and nursery rhyme-like and simple.
Yeah, I think he got the last laugh.
Exactly. When you have a very simple thing that you can instantly understand that overrides, that's more dominant than the more complex arrangement in music, that's why in pop music they call it the hook, because it grabs you by the throat and it doesn't give you a choice and it pulls you in. So works for the same reason that they work for the same reason. And again, that's why, so 350 years later, that's why a dominant melody over a more complex arrangement is what allows you to enter the complex arrangement. It's what allows you to enter the technique and bright colors of Warhol. It's what allows you to enter the complex and beautiful technique of Van Gogh. You first need this overarching, simple thing to magnetize you. And again, Warhol was a brilliant guy, and most people don't know this, that he was a realist advertising artist before he became the most successful pop artist of all time. He could draw your face if he were sitting in front of you, Douglas, photo real. So he figured out something. With all that vast knowledge of realism, he chose to create these monolithic simplicities. So the same way that a Warhol works is the same reason that a road sign works or a warning label works. If we see a radiation sign or a skull and crossbone, something with negative space around it that's big and oversized, it instantly locks our attention, and it does it every time. And it doesn't matter if there's millions and millions of them, it works every time. There's billions of road signs. We always stop and look at them because they operate off of the same principle as a Michael Jackson melody or a Phil Collins melody or a Madonna melody or Sesame Street. like a simple, massive, overarching image taking up with negative space around it, taking up your entire computer screen over the more complex arrangement. And once you lock onto that, then you'll connect to the more complex information. And then these two things have a binary relationship. The complex information then starts feeding your connection to the simple that you led with. And the simple that you led with gives people something to anchor to when they're looking at something complex. And there's been scientific studies of this that show that when people are taught with visual imagery, their capacity to learn goes way, way up. What they remember goes up. How much they enjoy learning goes up when they can anchor complex information to a large visual anchor or a sonic anchor. So, and then this goes on and on with concepts. Can I keep talking?
I have lots of extra audio tape.
Okay, so I'll give you this example. Another example I give in the book is how it works with speech writing.
Oh, yes.
So if you look at the most famous speech, I went to school in London, as you mentioned at the top, you know, and one of the things that shocked me when I was in London is that people know that I Have a Dream speech all over the world. Mm-hmm. People know that speech from in Malaysia. They know that speech when they're from, you know, Buenos Aires or from all over the world. I was surprised when I, you know, going to college overseas, how that really is probably the most famous speech in human history. And in what's a relatively short speech of just over 1,600 words, Martin Luther King uses the words "Let freedom ring" or "I have a dream" approximately every 85 words. And they're emotional. And he repeats them over and over. And what I'm arguing is that works for the same reason that the melody that Mama Say Mama Sa Mubaku Sa works, the melody from Ode to Joy works, or the Van Gogh works. It's this simple, repetitive thing that you lock onto. And when you put that amongst something that has great value, it allows people to connect with the value. And what I'm saying, in this world that's overloaded with content, unless you lead with these repetitive, simple phrases, whether visual or conceptual, no one will see you. So another example in that chapter in the book, I call it The Dreamer and the Fighter, give or take 20 plus years prior. Winston Churchill gave a famous speech to help galvanize a weary and battered British people in their support to continue on and hold the course throughout World War II. And so at the end of that speech, and it was not called this speech when it was originally, when he originally gave it, he has this repetitive phrase where he says, "We shall fight. We shall fight in the streets. We shall fight in the beaches. We shall fight," right? And he repeats it over and over. Today, it's known as the "We Shall Fight" speech. And it's that repetitive phrase that is actually historically credited with galvanizing British support to stay the course in the war. So these blocks that become icons, the anatomy of an icon, they can do more than just grab attention. They can motivate people to do things. They can cause people to retain the more complex information that you're trying to teach them. They really are quite a magical thing in terms of how they affect the way we think.
So in that instance, we're not talking just about graphic design, because I could sense how a listener might be thinking, okay, he's talking about graphic design, but actually no, these icons and blocks aren't exclusively visual. In those speeches, that was more of an auditory block.
Yeah, I mean, they work everywhere. One of the examples I give in the book is, I say, if you were to say to somebody, "Do you know that you're living in geometry?" They might look at you confused. And I say, "I'm going to make you a deal. I want you to walk around the block, and you can't come back till you've counted every geometric shape that you can possibly find in that course of you walking around the block." It might take them a week or a month to walk around the block, because geometric shapes are the building blocks of all of our structures, right? So every brick, if it's a street, it can be every square inlay in a street, every arch, every window. These are all geometric shapes. So, but we don't think that we're walking around in geometry until I point it out to you. And then you go, "Of course, I'm walking around in geometry all day, every day." When you read my book, which is very easy to read, I worked it very hard to make it conversational. Once you start to read the book, you'll see these blocks everywhere and all around you. It'll change the way that you look at your environment.
Yes, and I couldn't argue, as you mentioned earlier, as I was reading the books, I'm like, damn it, this guy's right. I can't I can't find any daylight here. This is all very tight. We're going to take a break here so I can tell you more about David Meerman Scott's new Marketing Mastery course and a very generous discount he's offering to Marketing Book Podcast listeners. Two books have had the biggest impact on my marketing career, and one of them is David Meerman Scott's The New Rules of Marketing and PR. Naturally, I'm a big fan of David Meerman Scott, which is why he was the very first guest on the Marketing Book Podcast and why he's returned several times. His new marketing mastery course, 3 years in the making, in collaboration with Tony Robbins, teaches you step by step the most important aspects of modern marketing so that your marketing can drive dramatically better sales results. Many of the mistakes I see companies make in their marketing can be avoided by following what's recommended in this comprehensive course. The new Marketing Mastery course has over 50 videos, over 25 infographics and worksheets, and a 50-page workbook that gives you step-by-step instructions on topics like buyer personas, content, social media, and building a business growth plan. Now, you can continue spending money having a good time going to marketing conferences or hiring consultants, but for a lot less, you can get this course, implement what he teaches, and start seeing measurable results. And your whole team can use it, which is why it's a great way to train your marketing team, particularly new hires. The knowledge you can get from the latest edition of the New Rules of Marketing and PR is why I continue to recommend it as the one book to help people get a better handle on what they need to understand about modern marketing and the modern buyer. Now, with this course, you can learn how to turn that knowledge into action. The secret to getting ahead is getting started. For you to get started, go to newmarketingmastery.com and enter the promo code MARKETINGBOOK to get $500 off the price. Go to newmarketingmastery.com and make sure to enter promo code MARKETINGBOOK to get $500 off. I also have a video about the course and a link to it in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now back to the show. I want to quote again. This is going to be the quote episode.
I'm really flattered that you're quoting over and over.
Well, it's just, you say, the future of all engagement is an information superhighway that we are all hurtling down. We want to turn off at the right exit. Having more information thrown at us than we can possibly process means we lock onto the signs we think will help us get where we want to go. People only get off on their own exit and will reject information that doesn't relate to their journey. This is important to remember. When we're driving somewhere, we're not going to change our destination just because another road sign looks nicer. And if you're trying to reach an audience, you're unlikely to reach one that wasn't already looking for what you have to offer. So, Jamie, and then a few pages later, you talk about how it's important to keep in mind that a block or icon is not a slogan. It's a statement of purpose or a result you achieve. So explain what you mean there.
I mean, if you look at like the history, if you look at the history of slogans, what you know, or a tagline, people, all businesses feel this need to have a tagline, and so many of them are either not honest or cheesy, and that didn't really matter 30, 40 years ago before the internet, but in a world where people are hit with so much that they can't see anything, these kind of meaningless taglines, it's like the March of the Wooden Soldiers, they just keep coming, actually become repulsive. So, I mean, there used to be ads in the 50s like a camel a day keeps the doctor away, right? Mm-hmm. Or wholesome hostess. I mean, that's the last thing that a
Twinkie.
Yeah, a Twinkie is, or have a Coke and a smile. Yeah, I smile for 10 minutes after I have a Coke, and then I crash and feel like I got punched in the face. Mm-hmm. McDonald's, you know, we're loving it. These things don't mean anything. But when you see people do them, it's an attempt. They know they need to lead with the simplicity, so they're reaching. But because they don't understand what they're trying to do with that slogan or tagline, which is to create a simplicity and anchor a block, they just come up with all this meaningless, alliterative crap that doesn't help you. So I give, you know, a few examples in the book, but one of the examples I give is, and this is the difference between, say, Lehman Brothers, "No Family Left Behind." What does that even mean? And it's definitely not true after 2008. Okay.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything. And then they're just endless. Mm-hmm. America first, you know, change, right? Some of them are better than others. But I give the example of FedEx in the 1970s with their very bold, monolithic campaign when it absolutely positively has to be there overnight. Now, you're talking the 70s. This is before fax machines, before any digital communication. If you had a trust for an inheritance that you had to get at a particular date, or a loan application or anything that had to be there in the next day, this was the only way to get a valuable document to somebody in a very short period of time. It wasn't instant with a click. So that statement, when it absolutely positively has to be there overnight, that's a statement of purpose or a result that is achieved. And it's a gut punch for somebody that needs to get a document somewhere. It doesn't give them a choice. It speaks directly to their core desires of what they need. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about creating a road sign.
And I had to smile because I'd worked in advertising for so many years, where you said that ad firms know they need to boil a message down to something that can be perceived instantly, and they rarely know how to distill it into something we truly care about. And that, for me, was one of the most important parts of the book, and that's why you prize this concept throughout. There was an expression that we've already started using here in the office that we've stolen from your book.
All right.
And it's called, that's not their ice water. That's not their ice water. Tell the story, because we were talking about prospective customers for a client, or even our prospective customers. We've got to go back to what their ice water is. Tell us the story of Wall Drug.
It's a very famous landmark now, almost 100 years later, if you're traveling through the Dakotas.
It's in Wall, South Dakota.
In Wall, South Dakota, in the Depression, this pharmacist, he wanted to move to a town where he could stand out. So he took a meager inheritance that he had. Again, we're talking about Depression America in the middle of nowhere.
$3,000.
With $3,000, which at that time would have been a lot of money. But
yeah,
when you're opening a business, probably took all of it. He moved his family to this little town and set up shop. And then he quickly realized it was a depression and there was an interstate where people were driving through by the town and nobody was stopping in the town. And he quickly panicked and wondered if he'd made the right decision for his business and his family. Well, his wife, and I think her name is
Dorothy.
Dorothy. I think that's my grandmother's name, so I get it confused. But she had this idea of, okay, well, people aren't coming into the town to our pharmacy, but people are driving by on the highway. What do these people need? Well, it's hot out there on that interstate, and we didn't have air conditioning the way we do have it now. So Dorothy said, why don't we offer free ice water at our pharmacy and put up a huge sign on the interstate? That's what people need. And then they'll come off and they'll see the other things that we have. So they went out and they put up this massive billboard, free ice water off the interstate. Before the billboard was even done, being like just as it was getting assembled, the pharmacy was overwrought with people. Okay. And today, Wall Drugs is a national landmark. And anyone that's driving through there that sells everything you can imagine that's been built off that legacy. It's the point being is that no matter what you do, whether you're a musician, you're a scientist, you're a CEO, you're trying to get buy-in from your colleagues, you're any kind of professional, whoever you're trying to reach has that thing that's their ice water. That's the thing that they need. And if you take that, and a huge part of this, and this is the part of my book that not enough people talk about, and I wish people talked about more, is it's not just enough to figure out what that ice water is, what that intersect point between something you can offer, the best of what you have to offer, and what people care about is, that there's an intersect point. But based on that visual acuity thing, it has to be oversized. You have to communicate it with negative space in Sesame Street type ways. And that's a huge part of why it works. I would even argue that if you had a big Sesame Street image with a bad slogan on a website, and then there were better slogans on 10 other sites, the one with the Sesame Street oversized communication would win over the better communication and messaging. So it's not what you'll learn in my book is it's not just about getting that intersect point between the best of what you have to offer and what the people you're trying to reach really care about. That's a formula. You find that intersect point, you have the block, you have the thing that you can repeat that will become iconic to them. But you have to communicate it in a way that is so massive and oversized that it magnetizes their lizard brain, their attention. And then if you get it right, it's a double whammy. It becomes a hook.
Right. And but there are many, many things they were selling in that drugstore. They could have talked about any number of them, but they were forced to boil it down to what that customer wanted at that time. And that became the block or the tip of the spear, the tip of the arrow, as you talk about, versus and all the other stuff was the shaft. And I was wondering if you could give yet another example of how Intel figured this out.
Yeah, I mean, Intel had a product. I mean, this is 10 years ago. They created this computer chip, and this is when it was starting to get more competitive for them. There was, you know, companies like AMD were starting to kind of, you know, lots more companies were starting to enter the marketplace, and their kind of virtual monopoly, they were starting to be encroached upon. Very good products with competitive prices were starting to take their market share. And they had in ways to combat that, they were coming up with innovations. Then they created a product called a vPro. And the vPro had all sorts of advantages for businesses. You could turn computers on and off from a distance. You could upload. You could say you had 2,000 employees and you wanted to have all of them have the same software update all at the same time. The vPro would allow a central IT guy to upload everybody's new software or new software update all at once. So it gave tremendous advantage over other computer chips. And so Intel started putting this in a vast number of their business-to-business, their enterprise computers. But nobody was using it. Nobody was turning them on, and they were trying to figure out how to solve it.
And they weren't getting much sales traction.
They were doing it as an add-on to make their product more appealing. But nobody was using it. So if nobody turns on the chip once they have the computer, then they don't have any competitive advantage. It just becomes like every other processor. Okay? So they needed people to turn this thing on to show them that people saw this as if I can get a processor that will do this in my computer when no one else has it, they needed to get people to be using it. Nobody was using it even when they were giving it away, just adding it in. So what they eventually figured out is that engineering guys had worked, you know, the people that created the chip had worked so hard to create all the 25 features, and they were leading on their vPro website with 25 features. They wanted to share everything. And so nothing was being communicated because they were trying to communicate 25 things at once. What they eventually discovered was what was most appealing to their enterprise or their corporate clients was corporate security, that they could remote wipe 2,000 laptops remotely, or if a laptop got stolen, they could remote wipe it and nobody could steal their corporate information.
But there were 24 things they didn't really care about.
Eventually, they decided to lead with that. They decided to lead with that one thing, that this was a cutting edge way to protect their corporate information. They led with it as a security device. And then now if you go on the vPro side, it's like bleeding edge security in an unwired world.
Right.
That means something to people that are IT guys that need to protect information, which is their target audience. That means nothing to me. But if I'm an IT guy and part of my mandate at Oracle headquarters is to be able to protect information if a laptop is stolen, bleeding edge security in an unwired world is a punch in the face. It's a road sign. So I'll go and look at what that is. Then once you look, then they show you the other 24 features after they've got your attention. Then you go, wow, and it does all these things, and then they've got you. So again, I said this at the top of the conversation, anything that's busy in a world where people are being bombarded with content gets instantly discarded. And like you said, when you read from the book, and you may be losing them forever, give them a road sign, one single thing, oversized proportionally, that they care about, and then they will engage with the more complex and intricate aspects of what you have to say.
Yes, and for those IT managers, that ability to shut down or wipe all those laptops that are distributed wherever the teams were, that was the exact same thing as ice water to somebody driving across the hot prairie in the 1930s. Once they got to the store, they were happy to buy stuff.
Yeah. And it's so true. And you know what's interesting about it is sometimes, because I do this for clients, right? I do this for every kind of person you could imagine. And what's always shocking to me is how many successful business leaders I do it for, people that have huge companies, but they don't feel like their company is getting the traction that it could deserve if people really understood it, even though they may already be very successful. But what I tell people is, even if it came, took you 6 months to come up with what that ice water phrase is, and you really took my advice on making it oversized, that 6 months would save you 10 years, 20 years, and it would do more for your business than anything else you could imagine. Because without that, you're experiencing massive amounts of drag and you don't even know it. Because it's so close to us, people don't even see it. And it creates this chasm that 90% of businesses fall into. And scientific innovations and even ways to get people to look at your art. It's a pothole that is covered up that we don't see. And so many people fall into it that even if it took you 6 months, you could the amount of friction and drag that you would be removing and lifting off your business is incredible.
Yes, and there's plenty of stories in the book that talk about businesses that were able to get out of their own heads long enough to be able to understand it. And also it brought to mind the concept of empathy and how hard that is for companies to put themselves in the shoes of the customers, or even put themselves in the shoes of their real buyers. So a lot of times companies are talking about things that aren't even relevant to the people that are making the decisions about buying their products or services. So in the remaining time, I did want to ask, though, about what you have towards the end of the book about transparency in this new world. Can you talk about the importance of transparency now versus pre-internet? You know, where we're all connected now, explain why transparency is so much more important now.
Well, once I explain in the book how to create a singular kind of monolithic message that magnetizes people, then I kind of go on to show you some different techniques of how to amplify that. It'll work even if it's weak, if it's just oversized. But there's things you can do to galvanize, electrify, magnetize, amplify what you're trying to say. And one of the five most watched TED Talks of all time was Brené Brown talking about vulnerability and how vulnerability creates connection. What businesses are trying to do is they want true connection with their customers. And the reason they want true connection with their customers is because when people actually have a real connection, they make you the first choice and they come back over and over and over again. So Brené Brown explains that when we're vulnerable as human beings, where we connect with people in deeper ways. Now that TED Talk, which is actually a TEDx Houston, again, has probably 60 million views, one of the most watched TED Talks of all times as a TEDx. So what I explain is that the corporate or business version of vulnerability, the thing that creates connection, is being truthful and open about who you are as a company. And that causes people to connect with you on a deeper level because they feel like you're letting them in. And that will galvanize your road sign or that thing that you lead with and make it even more magnetic to the people that you're trying to reach.
There's just a few other things in here that are just solid gold. Like you talk about in this digital age, companies that prop themselves up as perfect just lose the trust of their audiences. In other words, they're thinking from the past, where you talked about when before the internet, when people could check on their own, the advertising or whatever the companies were saying about themselves was not the only source of information. Why is it so harmful for companies that are trying to look perfect?
Well, I think you nailed it. I mean, if it was 1950 and we were looking at a catalog and we saw a sign saying we're the best outdoor motor for your fishing boat in the world, and it was the most expensive one, that would be your only real source of information unless you were an engineer or something. So that would be believable.
Right. Or it's like in the movie Elf, when Elf sees that greasy spoon diner and it says on the outside of it, the world's best cup of coffee. And he comes inside and said, congratulations on making the world's best cup of coffee.
Exactly. I mean, we have a society where people, if you look at advertising is full of unsubstantiated claims. And another word for an unsubstantiated claim is a lie. So you come out and tell the truth about your product or service, but no one believes you because you're in a climate of liars. That's what transparency overcomes. So because we've got so used to doing this, like claiming we're the best, and now people can check how good you are in a 30-second Google search. They can look at your Yelp reviews. They can look at your Google reviews. They can look at your Glassdoor reviews. So trying to tell them that you're the best when they can all check now and do in 10 seconds actually repulses them.
Yes. They're immediately thinking, prove it.
Yeah. It's like, so if you lead with a transparency, something vulnerable, like an example I give in the book is Domino's Pizza did during the economic crisis in 2008, they decided to admit that to their customers that their pizza sucked and that they were determined to improve it. That willingness to take a hard look at themselves and admit that about themselves and go on this quest with the public to improve their pizza, but even caused them to have an unprecedented stock rise and enable them to take a large percentage of market share at a time where most fast casual restaurants were struggling. I mean, pizza places did better during the recession because you can feed a family for $10. But what Domino's did during that time in terms of being vulnerable with, hey, our pizza's bad and we're going to fix it. Our pizza sucks and we're going to fix it is unprecedented.
Yeah. Well, they did have to fix it. Can you imagine if United Airlines said, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't have dragged those people off our plane against their will, and maybe it's not a good idea for our baggage handlers to smash up guitars. I think that would really get everyone's attention, and they might say, wow, all right, maybe I will fly United on my next trip where I need to, you know, pick them.
I think if you could admit that you're wrong, and it's not just about being wrong, there's other ways that we can be transparent. Mm-hmm. As companies, we can tell people how the inner workings of our company works. You know, I'm doing a large rebrand on a Northwest legacy company right now, and they have a lot of stuff made in China at what is one of the most environmentally sustainable and environmentally advanced manufacturing facilities in the world. More environmentally advanced than anything they could afford or even maybe even find here.
This is in China?
This is in China.
Wow.
So they asked me, they said, you know, can you turn us into a Northwest legacy brand? And I said, yeah, I can do it as long as you tell the story of this incredible innovator in China that is 30 years ahead of most U.S. manufacturers when it comes to automation and environmental stewardship. As long as you celebrate that and explain how this guy has the same values that we have here in the Northwest about making things the right way and about making things in a way that we're stewards for the environment. Be open about it. Celebrate them. Don't be embarrassed of them. And heck yeah, I'll do it for you. So we're in the middle of doing that, and that's going to launch in the next month or so. So wow. That's where most people kind of want to hide that. I said, lead with it.
Yes, yes.
And when I created a story for them that showed very clearly that the Northwest values that built this company that's 75 years old, and the value of this CEO in China, who I actually got to interview in person when he came to the United States, they have the exact same values, right? So, and I was able to tell that story, and I think that it's going to make them very successful.
Yeah, imperfection actually can enhance your credibility. And if you're trying to look perfect, people are suspicious.
Yeah. These days, when people can check anything in a second, and you say, you try to communicate you're perfect with a meaningless tagline or any sort of just or proclamation of perfection, you're insulting their intelligence because they know they like, hey, you know, I can check this, right? They don't think it, but they feel it. It's like a bass note. Okay. You don't hear it, but you feel it. So it actually ends up repulsing people and they don't even know why they're feeling repulsed.
Yes. And there was another line in the book where you talk about how self-obsessed advertising now comes across as crazy. It's just so unbelievable. And I brought to mind an expression I once heard at a talk where a lot of advertisers, they talk about themselves and, you know, we this and we that. And this speaker said they're weeing all over themselves. And now it's even more harmful that they're doing that. So, Jamie, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Just to kind of touch off the point that you just made, when I first started doing this work, I just wanted to be like Malcolm Gladwell. I came across this idea and I thought this is really important for people. And I spent, you know, the next decade and a half of my life helping people with it. writing about it. And my goal was to just give people these rules. Well, as I did it for people, and I made people stand out in every medium you can imagine, from politicians to, you know, it's really small businesses that I love to help. Small, medium businesses, large corporations, CEOs. I've done it for artists you never heard of, successful artists, scientists, engineers. It's the best part of my job is digging into all these incredible fields and innovations that people do. Something really magical happened. And that is, you know, especially I'll give a small business example. I thought I was just going to help that business do better. But I would do it for someone, whether it's a CEO of a $2 million business or a multi-billion dollar business. And they would see it and they would start to deploy it even before they would start to deploy it, and their face would change and they would look happier. And I realized that being able to be seen and get your business the attention, or your art or your science or your innovation the attention it deserves, is more than just business. For small business owners, it's their mortgage. It's their kids' college. It's their identity. It's how they move through the world. And I saw that it made better people when they were able to get attention for the right reasons, for who they transparently were. So their inside matched their outside. It made for better people. So it'll make you, so that to me, I guess, is the social takeaway. How being able to communicate and get attention at will makes you a better human being.
Mm. Well, just for fun, what is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book?
They could take one point of customer contact. These days, our main shingle is our website. It's like the front, door was from the 1950s, the front of our store. Mm-hmm. And they could take one statement that's an intersect point between the best of what they have to offer as a company, whether it's ice water or getting it there overnight. You know, what's the best thing that they can do that is the most important thing to their customers? Because you said it before, it's not about us. This is not a put down on innovators and business owners. You know, when you make something and you spend all your time making something and then you've got to get and go sell it. And I don't ever use the word marketing, because most people, time when I use the word marketing with CEOs, they want to get off the phone. They associate the word with losing money or breaking even. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many, it's so difficult now to be seen. And I love the name of your podcast, Douglas. I'm not.
No, I know there's a perception thing, and there's also a little bit of maybe mixed in with what you just described as thinking like they're buying a lottery ticket. If we could just get Mark Cuban to tweet about our company.
Yeah. So I don't use that word anymore because, yeah, I think it has a lottery ticket vibe. That being said, plenty of people do. And I love the name of your podcast because, you know, in a lot of ways, my book can help you be successful in the market. So it's not anyone's fault that they communicate about themselves too much. It's human nature when Yes. you make something to talk about all of it. And it's hard to look at yourself and figure out what that one thing is. But if you can find the one thing about you that intersects with the thing that your customer most cares about, and you can take it and have it take up the first two-thirds of the top of your webpage, like Sesame Street, and then have some information that follows it that explains the claim, right? Like Simon Sinek, start with why. I believe it's the why or the result we achieve that gets people to look at us. But if you don't say it big enough in a Sesame Street-like way, your why won't matter. Mm-hmm. So say it at your first most important point of customer contact. Say it in a Sesame Street-type way. Make sure it's the best of you, even if it's an obscure part of you, to what your customers truly care about. Say it massive. And it will reduce drag and friction, and it will change the way your company engages in the world, and you will grow in ways faster than you thought possible.
Yes, that's a great idea. Might even be kind of fun. So what books have inspired your working career?
Well, I mentioned earlier the book, The Shallows by Nicholas Carr, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. That's a great book. There's a book called Tribe by Sebastian Younger.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
About connection, how modern society has kind of made it so that we're less connected. And he gives all these incredible stories and examples. The book that I just read that I love, that really communicates about, I mean, it's such a simple book, but it communicates about passion in relation. How do we attach passion to our work? You know, some people that have businesses really believe in this concept of passion. Most of the businesses I talk to, they don't really connect this word passion and success. It's kind of almost like a woo concept. Well, there's a guy named Steve Sims. His father was a bricklayer. He's from the East End of London, and he was a bricklayer. Now he lives successful. He's in the Hollywood Hills. He's one of the most sought-after speakers in the world. He's got a book called Blue Fishing, and about how he came from being a bricklayer to being the most successful high net worth concierge in the world. If there's you want an impossible thing to happen, you want to have a date with Rihanna, this is the guy you call. And he has a point in his book where he talks about how passion and business connect and how that can affect your success in business. That I think is very practical, very easy to read. And I think almost anybody that's cynical about passion and success in business could read that and see how they could utilize passion to generate more sales and to get way more demand for their business and to differentiate themselves from their competitors. So I love the way he talks about passion in relation to practical work in blue fishing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that sounds great. I wasn't aware of that one. That's got me kind of excited. So I'll have to check that out. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you've heard about or look forward to seeing?
Well, Alexander Watkins' book, just in a second edition, just came out. Hello, My Name is Awesome. You talked about her. Mm-hmm. There's a book coming out on Bembella on the subject of artificial intelligence. I mean, this kind of goes out of my wheelhouse, called T-Minus AI by a guy named Michael Kanin, who's really young. He's 30 years old, and he's the co-chair for artificial intelligence for the Air Force. And he was on the Forbes 30 under 30 list. And he is a brilliant, brilliant young guy. And he's a really down-to-earth guy that you'd want to have a beer with. And he talks about the future of AI, artificial intelligence, and what it means for our lives. And I think that's coming out on Bembella in May or June, but you could Google it.
What we'll do is make sure to include a link to that and all the other books that you've mentioned in your episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And we'll include the links to your social media and your LinkedIn profile. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Iconist, The Art and Science of Standing Out. The author is Jamie Mustard. Jamie, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I loved it. I loved the conversation, Douglas.
And that closes the book on episode 270 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, David Merriman Scott's New Marketing Mastery Course. Get $500 off with promo code MARKETINGBOOK when you check out at newmarketingmastery.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Jeff Davis to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book about sales and marketing alignment, Create Togetherness. Transform sales and marketing to exceed modern buyers' expectations and increase revenue. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Jessica Ambrose.